Government Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, theology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. It's so nice to have you with us on this July the 10th on the West Coast, and now July the 11th, 2009, on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Well, we have a very interesting show planned for you, and we're going to get right into it in a moment. That sounds like an oxymoron, and I guess in a way it is. The news that everyone is waiting for regarding the Three Stooges Go to Washington Part 7, that will be forthcoming by the end of the week. I'm anticipating having the article either tomorrow late in the evening or sometime Sunday. I can't predict what time. Anticipating for delays, hang-ups, Lord knows what might happen. I've assembled everything. It's in a chronological order. I've basically said everything that I feel needs to be said to dispel the myths that people all over the world have been arguing over the past year and a half or so. And I've had already sufficient indication that this research has struck some nerves, that damage control has swung into effect, and ultimately the truth has to come out, and this is a doozy. This is a multi-layered, multi-tiered, multi-dimensional investigative piece that I have to say, without bragging, I'm proud of, just because I know that I worked with a lot of inspiration from my listening audience, my readership, my publishers, my editors, and with God. And I should put God first, and I do. God intends for this information to come out. For some people, it's going to seem like a stretch of the imagination. All creativity uses imagination. In fact, if you don't stretch your imagination muscles, nothing gets created. However, this is the connection of truth and the realization, the discernment of truth, all, let's say, congealing together in the form of light. And when you take the light of truth and you shine it on lies and deception and corruption and evil, you shine it on the darkness, and it exposes that which hides in the darkness, and that's what this piece does. And so I hope a lot of people finally wake up and see what's been going on. This is not fiction. In fact, what we've been fed is fiction. I'm convinced of that. And they've used every means possible to hide the truth from people, but the truth itself doesn't need to be protected. It's not hiding from anything. It's been out there all along. It's just been our inability to see it. And hopefully, after you've read The Three Stooges Go to Washington Part 7, you will see the truth, and then you can make some decisions as to what has to take place. And that's the purpose for the piece. That's the purpose for the work I do. That is the purpose for this show. Now, we have a very interesting show planned for you with our regular Friday night guest, who is not only our resident science advisor, he is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and my very good friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Yes, darling, thank you very much. How are you this evening?
I'm fired up, I got to tell you.
Yeah, you sound fired up.
Do I? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, with
so
good
I'll,
reason.
I'll be honest with you, I'm fired up too.
Okay.
So that should make for an interesting couple on this show.
What fires Jim Murray up, if I might ask? this man that has devoted his life to studying, understanding, creating, and sharing power with humanity. What fires him up?
Well, actually, there's a lot of things that fire me up. There's quite a bit of passion still around. You know, the old expression, just because there's snow on the roof doesn't mean the fire is out in the basement.
That's funny.
But the thing that has me fired up this evening is the date, because
yes,
today is actually a very special day.
Yes, and I'm almost embarrassed because you reminded me earlier this evening of the date, which I had recalled during my monologue show on July 1st, and I intended to remind you of that, and you reminded me. And even when you dropped hints on me, you said, "What's today?" And I said, "Friday." And he said, "I mean, what day is it?" And I said, "Well, it's Friday, July 10th." And it didn't register. I had made a mental note a few weeks ago, at least within the last 10 days, to remind you about it. So I'm ashamed of myself for not having recalled that.
Well, I wouldn't be ashamed. Things like that happen. But the important part is at least one of us remembered. And for the people out there listening who are wondering what the heck we're talking about, today is Tesla's birthday. And that means quite a bit to me, considering I've tried to model some of my life after this great guy.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, Don, with your permission, there's an article that I would like to read, which I wrote a number of years ago, in honor of this guy, our friend Tesla. And it's called A Tribute to Genius. And I thought that this was a very good day to read that and fill people in on some of his contributions to humanity, because not everybody realizes what this gentleman has done for us.
Yes, that's true. Now, if I can make one comment before you start reading, today
is your show.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to be rude and interrupt you. I do that enough anyway. So today would be the 153rd anniversary of Tesla's birthday. And I happened to talk to a good friend, Drew Raines, about this issue tonight, that we were going to be talking about this on tonight's show. And he informed me that he brought that up on first hour of his show, which I couldn't get on the Internet today. There were just some streaming issues. But I'm going to go back and listen to what he had to say. So there are others out there that are aware of this, but I know that you are particularly fond of Tesla's work, as I am. You know that I've actually written about his demise and a little bit about his career in a piece that I did in the Idaho Observer a couple of years ago. And so I honor what you're about to share with us. And I'll mute my mic. Take it away, Jim.
Okay, thank you, Don. Actually, this is part of the introduction to a book that I started to write on the subject, and hopefully I'll live long enough to finish it. But in the meantime, the opening couple of pages here are worth listening to. It's called A Tribute to Genius. Several years before the turn of the century, in the city of Budapest, Hungary, a tall, gaunt man from Serbia struggles to regain his health. For months, he has been in the grip of a strange and violent malady that has threatened to take his life. His convalescence is slow, but his will to live is indomitable. His name is Nikola Tesla. As his strength returns, Tesla's thoughts turn with eagerness to the resumption of his professional duties at the Budapest Telephone Exchange, and to the solution of a problem that has vexed his mind since the second year of engineering school, the harnessing of alternating currents. Always having found great fortification of spirit in nature, the weakened Tesla retreats to a city park to enjoy an outing. He is in the company of a former classmate, Zagetti. It is late afternoon in February. The year is 1881. The dazzling colors in the prismatic sky announce the coming of sunset. The brilliant spectacle infuses life into Tesla's troubled soul. His entire being is seized by the contrast between this display of cosmic wholeness and the integrated essence that he perceives as himself. The mysteries of the objective and subjective realities seem to merge. Some great truth seems evident, nearly tangible. He is deeply moved. His sense of the aesthetic escalates to the point of spontaneous expression, and he begins to recite a verse from Faust. The glow retreats. Done is the day of toil. It yonder hastens, new fields of life exploring. Oh, that no wing can lift me from the soil. Upon its track to follow, follow soaring. Suddenly, Tesla is silent, staring rigidly into the orb of the setting sun. Zagetti is alarmed and tries to rouse him, but without success. Then, as if from a dream, Tesla speaks. His voice is charged with emotion. See it? Watch it? It's spinning. Watch me reverse it. In a moment of unparalleled lucidity, the mind of a noble man has merged with the mental fabric of a higher consciousness and has captured a grain of truth to share with mankind. During those few seconds of inspiration, Nikola Tesla has discovered the principle of the rotating magnetic field, the very foundation upon which our entire polyphase electrical technology is constructed. Tesla was just 25 years old. Those events mark the beginning of a career unsurpassed to this day by any individual in the electrical field. During the remaining 62 years of his life, Tesla was awarded 36 patents for inventions pertaining to motors and generators, 9 major patents involving the transmission of electrical power, 6 patents concerning lighting, 17 patents on the design of high-frequency apparatus, 12 patents on radio, 7 patents on turbines and similar devices, and many other patents too numerous to itemize. My first encounter with Tesla's work occurred in 1962 when I was a sophomore in high school. I remember having read an article which debated the feasibility of Tesla's plans to light the 1903 International Exhibition in Paris with power generated at Niagara Falls and transmitted to Europe by wireless means. The story had first appeared in the Electrical World and Engineer, March 5, 1904, where mention was made of Tesla's intention to combine the art of wireless communication with that of wireless transmission of power. During the early 60s, my technical interests were completely directed towards the design and implementation of linear particle accelerators. Already, I had received a first-place award in the New England Science Talent Search and had my sights set on scholarships and grants. I had no time for ancient inventors. However, I do remember wondering, how does one transmit 10,000 horsepower across half the globe without wires? In 1965, my senior year in high school, my father died suddenly, and with him, unfortunately, so did my plans to study physics at MIT. The following fall, instead of attending college, I started work as an electrician in a small New Jersey shipyard. I was 18 years old. I worked during the day and attended college at night, and it wasn't long before I encountered my old friend Tesla again. It was in a book called Experiments with High Frequency Currents by Thomas C. Martin, and I located it in the rare book section of my college library and devoured it cover to cover. It had a profound effect upon me. Immediately, I began to direct all of my free time towards investigations of Tesla's work. I quickly became addicted to the great scientist's interests and to his goals, his methods. However, I also discovered that there were precious few books of substance written about this rare man. Although a virtual blizzard of newspaper and magazine articles seemed to exist, especially on microfilm, I read all that I could find. I also acquired and read numerous times the great classic Prodigal Genius by John O'Neill. The very best source of information, however, was a book entitled Lectures, Patents, and Articles, which had been published in Yugoslavia. The more I studied Tesla's work and his accomplishments, the more I became convinced that something was terribly wrong somewhere. Why have so few of his experiments never been successfully duplicated in modern times? Why are his strongest claims regarded with such an air of skepticism by today's engineers? How could the same man who gave the world the polyphase electric motor, rotary transformers, robotics, radio, and the foundations of X-ray technology suddenly be considered mad or senile when he spoke of wireless transmission of electric power or the extraction of thousands of kilowatts directly from the ambient environment? Gradually, I learned to read between the lines as I studied his lectures and patents. Slowly, I came to the realization that in many cases, Tesla was speaking about very rare or very different scientific phenomenon with an attitude of absolute complacency, as if he felt that surely everyone understands this basic material. But everyone did not understand. They were still struggling to digest Tesla's earlier concepts. I learned, too, that Tesla did not trust most of his contemporaries. He never bothered to adjust his use of semantics to comply with accepted definitions. If he was misunderstood, he was unconcerned. As a result, after many years, this attitude eventually led to multiple interpretations of the meaning and intent of Tesla's later work. His statements were considered enigmatic, and meaningful communication between himself and the scientific community ceased altogether. But Tesla continued to expand upon his discoveries, seemingly unaware that the wisdom in his words fell upon deaf ears. Eventually, I became convinced that great knowledge had been lost or suppressed, and I set out to establish where Tesla had made his departure from the realm of recognized physics. Initially, I guided myself by intuition and by the implications hidden in various projects which Tesla felt strongly about, such as non-commutating DC motors and unusual forms of resonance. However, gradually I found myself focusing upon several interesting non-scientific facts. The fundamental patents for the invention of radio were issued to Nikola Tesla on September 2, 1897. Securing financial support from J.P. Morgan, Tesla promptly began construction of the first world wireless station at Wharton Cliff, Long Island in 1900. The magnificent 150-foot transmitting tower and associated power plant were completed in 1902, and Tesla anticipated operational activities by 1904. Marconi filed his original patent applications on November 10, 1900. They were unceremoniously rejected because of prior art in the name of Nikola Tesla. Marconi tried numerous times to obtain patents in his name, but his claims were continuously rejected. However, in 1904, Nikola Tesla fell out of favor with J.P. Morgan, and in that same year, on February 19th, Marconi requested a reconsideration of his patent case. This time, he was mysteriously awarded a patent on March 28th, 1904. The Marconi American Corporation began construction of a transatlantic transmitting station in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in 1913. This facility was then taken over by the United States Navy at the outbreak of World War I in 1917. Later that year, the General Electric Company, still owned and operated by affiliates of J.P. Morgan, supplied new high-frequency alternators of Tesla's design for the station, making it the most powerful radio transmitter in the world. After that year, the Radio Corporation of America was organized to maintain control of the newly emerging radio technology. The station at New Brunswick was reopened in 1921 for commercial use under the management of RCA. A gala affair was organized to inaugurate the reopening, and it was attended by some very impressive individuals, including Albert Einstein. One cannot help but wonder, what connection did Einstein's theory of relativity have with the subject of radio? Why was Nikola Tesla vehemently opposed to Einsteinian relativity? Why did Tesla shun the RCA affair? Why did Tesla threaten to publish his dynamic theory of gravity and thereby destroy the theory of relativity? What became of Tesla's theory of gravity and the information associated with it? Was Tesla engaged in a secret enterprise designed to short-circuit the effects of creative history writing? Genius Never Dies is a story that attempts to answer these interesting questions. The story is told through the character of Jake Morris, a Jersey City tough with a passion for physics. And Jake's investigations demonstrate that the exclusion of Nikola Tesla from the textbooks of radio and physics by his corporate and financial enemies may have eradicated much of his fame, but his unpublished knowledge is still intact and available to mankind. Well, anyway, there's some very interesting facts involved in that introductory writing. And one of the things that I thought we might explore together, with your permission again, Don, is one of the subjects that was closest to Tesla's heart and something in which he placed an awful lot of his life energies, and which unfortunately has led to nothing because of the activities of his enemies, and that is the wireless transmission of electrical power. So I think with that as an opening, it gives us some interesting things to focus upon, and God knows with the present condition of the world, some of Tesla's unpublished and misunderstood information regarding electrical power would certainly find receptive ears in modern times, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. If I can comment just briefly, because I don't want to eat up all this time, that's absolutely brilliant what you wrote. And I had the sensation that Tesla was actually listening to your presentation more than once. So I thought I'd share that with you. Certainly, he was in tune to what's going on in the universe when he was here. Why wouldn't he be now? A couple of things that came to mind, and you touched upon something that I wrote about. I don't consider myself the expert on Tesla, but what comes to mind is his involvement in the development of wireless radio transmission for the U.S. military. And if you remember that I talked about the offshore ship that they located off of Narragansett, Massachusetts, and their intention was to probably use that as some sort of a signal for ships coming in. They did it. Their intention was to construct this as a safety precaution. But what I determined was on the basis of some documents that were published by the government that that was a smokescreen and that it was probably used for covert purposes. It falls hand in hand with what you're describing concerning his struggles with Marconi. Eventually, Tesla was awarded the patent. By the way, that decision was reversed, and he was awarded the patent. But it became a means through which Morgan saw the opportunity to make enormous sums of money, and so he bypassed Tesla. It showed the lack of honor that these people have, that they will squash anyone like a bug that gets in their way. And so I have to honor Tesla's decision not to be corrupted by those that would fall prey to the dealings and the devices of some of these elite, as they like to call themselves. So you reminded me of that, and I hope I don't sound like I'm needlessly eating up valuable airtime.
No, not at all. I mean, that's what the show's about. It's a talk show. It's not a listen show. So,
okay, your turn to talk, Jim.
Well, that's not a problem. But there's some interesting things, you know, involved even in this whole mysterious area of scientific activity that links together the wireless transmission of information with the wireless transmission of power. And I've been digging into this for many years. I've duplicated in miniature some of Tesla's wireless work. And of course, I know other people who have done even more than I've done. And so there's a lot to be said for, you know, understanding what he was doing. The thing that's difficult to comprehend is not necessarily the principles involved, but the magnitude that he was prepared to do these things at. In other words, he wasn't afraid, you know, to resonate the entire planet. He wasn't afraid to, you know, deal in hundreds of millions of volts and only God knows how many amperes. You know, so there's a heck of a difference between tinkering something together in a laboratory that can transmit power, you know, let's say 50 feet, as opposed to what he was prepared to do with the entire globe. And the interesting thing is, even though he is the true originator of radio, as we make use of it today, he really didn't think much of it. And that's one of the things that I wanted to touch upon in the opening remarks about this wireless transmission of electrical power. Tesla's own words regarding his own discovery of radio are really pretty astonishing. He said that the invention of radio holds fascination for so many people that it's actually beyond his ability to comprehend, because nothing is less efficient than radio. And he compares it to a water sprinkler, a huge rotating water sprinkler that's throwing water all over this gigantic lawn. Mm-hmm. And he said that that's like the radio tower sending out this this stream of electromotive force in all this almost a hemispherical direction all over the place. And naturally, it takes an enormous amount of power to do that, because the part that actually leaves the antenna is already a minuscule fragment of what it takes to excite the antenna. But then you take it to the next order of degradation, and he says, if you could hold a thimble out into this this cascade of rain of artificial raindrops and catch, you know, a drop here and there, he said that's actually more than what the receiver picks up from the original transmitted signal. And worse than that, it doesn't, that information that's embedded in that signal is never listened to or detected by the human being at all. It's simply used as a blueprint upon which to build another signal that's loud enough for interpretation by human senses. So in the long run, you can hardly calculate the efficiency of radio as a system, you might say, between transmitter and receiver. It's so pathetic. And the thing that astonished him the most was the fact that regardless of that, it's the magic of sending something through an invisible medium that people get all excited about. Now, Tesla was much more enthralled with the concept of transmitting power on a wireless basis. And, of course, here's the part that's interesting. When you talk about wireless, even people that are old enough to think back around the time of, you know, even before World War II, the term wireless was very intrinsically linked with radio, because radio was kind of emerging from wireless. Mm-hmm. And so people still have this notion that Tesla was sending the power through the air, like a radio wave, or through space, like a radio wave. And if you look at the modern attempts to duplicate this transmission of power without wires, that's exactly what people are trying to do. They're trying to send power by microwaves or by induction or by all these scalar wave technologies, you know, point to point through empty space. And it's not that you can't get any results that way. It's just that you'll never be able to send millions of watts that way because you cook everything in between.
What you're saying, then, is Tesla conceived of a way for us to access the source of the power in a safe way.
Well, that came later, but actually, the initial source of power he provided, because he was more interested in understanding the mechanism that would allow for safe transmission. And what people don't realize is, in the Colorado Springs experiments, a lot of people think that was the forerunner for the complex that he later built at Wardenclyffe, Long Island, but actually that's not the case at all. The Wardenclyffe complex was essentially built as the first world communication system that would have incorporated just about every form of communication that you can imagine all in one glorious device. And that would have included such things as telephone, telegraph, facsimile, multiple channels of communication, and all of that. But it wasn't designed to transmit power. We have to remember that was the facility Morgan had originally funded because he wanted to communicate with ships leaving Europe and heading for the States, carrying all of his goods back and forth. And that was his original reason for funding Tesla. But the transmission of electrical power experiments were actually done in Colorado Springs at a very high altitude because Tesla was convinced of the importance that would be contributed to his experiments by the naturally charged air in that region. And there's some of the most horrific thunderstorms imaginable take place in that part of Colorado. And what's interesting about comparing the Tesla wireless power transmitter with standard radio transmission is the fact that they are the inverse of each other. When we have a radio station with a great big tower going up in the air, the other end of that oscillatory circuit is grounded, and the way the radio is tuned, the majority of the activity takes place in the antenna, and very little activity takes place through the ground connection, except for in the immediate vicinity of the station. But we already know that the electromagnetic waves leave the antenna and travel many, many miles. But what Tesla was actually doing with his station was the reverse of that. He had his equipment designed and tuned in such a way that the ground connection was actually in the capacitance of the large globe at the top of his power mast, and it was referred to as a virtual ground. And the equipment was tuned and designed in such a way that the maximum activity was in the ground plane connection. And so what he was actually doing was transmitting huge bursts of electrical activity into the ground to such an extent that it affected the electrical charge of the entire planet. And once he got that under control, and I mean that literally, because he was essentially ringing the planet at an electrical rate that he computed, you could literally take and put a receiver anywhere on the surface of the planet where you could locate a node, and you would essentially have electricity delivered to that point without any wires. And he did this experiment in Colorado and transmitted, I believe it was several thousand watts to a distance of 26 miles from the plant, with an efficiency of 99.9%, which is actually higher than what you would achieve if you had a cable running out that far. So there's a very big difference between radio and wireless transmission of power, because even though the word wireless got stuck in there, it doesn't mean there was no conductor. The planet itself was the conductor, and the work that he did in that direction, which led to his understanding of that, all came from experiments that he did earlier with one conductor or single conductor transmission of power on an AC circuit. And those are the things that I duplicated a number of years back, and other people have also. So it's a real interesting area of investigation, and most of the people that are looking into it now are actually modeling, trying to model the idea against radio, and that's incorrect.
Yes. Now, what came to mind while you were describing all of this, and I had come across these accounts to some extent in my own research, particularly his Colorado Springs experiment with what became known as the death ray, which may have been the cause of this gigantic explosion in the Tunguska in Russia, which was blamed on an asteroid, and he had felt that possibly he had created that, because in essence that ray followed the curvature of the Earth and eventually landed someplace. It didn't just go out into space. It probably caused that explosion. But what came to mind more than anything is that I considered where the world would be today had J.P. Morgan and others like him, possibly George Westinghouse, not metered electricity and not held onto this archaic system. What would have happened? And it's obvious why we weren't taught about Tesla, because all of these secrets would have been revealed over 100 years ago, and likely many, as they're doing today, would be attempting to accomplish alternative solutions to this controlled metering of power that enriches certain individuals, certain corporations, and their cronies to the demise of the rest of humanity. This is insanity, and I really resent the fact that that the exclusion of Nikola Tesla's life and his history and his wonderful inventions were used as one of the major ways to dumb down the populace. There were others. Religion, of course, played a role in that. But in terms of learning science in school, it should have been taught. He should have been the main character, actually. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, he lived long enough to see the genesis of television. And the interesting thing was, even though he wasn't involved with the research of that directly, I guess that was more Farnsworth and some of those guys, but he had predicted not only that it would happen, but how it would work, in essence, rather than in absolute terms, you know. So mm-hmm. You could tell that his mind was already going there. It's just that by the time all of that came to pass, the guy was becoming very old, and he was, of course, very broke. But his mind was still extremely active, and he was very aware of what could be done with this emerging medium. Now, I think, just from what I do know of the man, that he would be really annoyed, and that's probably being rather mild. He'd probably be infuriated if he saw the wonders of this medium, which he always envisioned as an educational medium and as a means of saving lives and sharing news and knowledge with the world. If he saw it being used as a hypnotic tool, you know, to enrich the governing class, shall we say, I think he would have really been annoyed at that. The interesting thing is that even though it wasn't accomplished with radio or television, the internet is actually operating more in line with what Tesla imagined than some of the earlier inventions like TV and radio, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting. It means that the idea survived, even though it didn't wind up in the clutches of the people who want to control all these things.
Mm-hmm. I'm of the opinion that Van Ever Bush was credited with as being the so-called progenitor of the computer as we know it today. And I'm not saying he didn't know anything about computer, you know, that technology, but to me it smacked of something that Tesla would have pioneered, at least those concepts. Do you have any thoughts on that? I think you and I have talked about this on a past show, too.
Oh, yeah, well, I can tell you without any hesitation that, first of all, it's very, very clear that Tesla understood the concepts of automation and robotics. I mean, he built these wireless boats that he had on display in Madison, in the original Madison Square Garden. And he had that operating on a routine basis, not only at Madison Square Garden, but also in the Hudson River, or the East River, I forget which one, but one of the two, while Marconi was still in school. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious who invented radio. But the thing that's much more interesting and in line with the question that you asked is the fact that while he was transmitting these signals from his portable little transmitter out to the boat, the interesting thing was that the signals were encoded, which is already quite an advancement from just sending a continuous wave, which people like Hertz and some of the other guys were experimenting with. He was already imprinting data on the radio signals, and then discriminating that data within the receiver and channeling the various commands throughout the systems on this boat so that he could turn the lights on and off, blow the whistle, slow the thing down, speed the thing up, turn it left, turn it right, make it go in reverse. I mean, he could do all of those things. And it was accomplished by computer. And if you look at the patent, there is actually a computer involved. Now, granted, it's not what we consider a computer today in terms of the fact that it didn't have any transistors. It didn't even have tubes. But what it did have were these little actuator solenoids that were designed to respond, you know, to the information embedded in these individualized signals. And in that regard, it was an analog computer, but it was actually what you might call a digital-to-analog converter and discriminator, because the signals came in more or less digitally, and then they actually were responsible for activating various mechanical linkages and whatnot aboard the craft. So it was a really complicated system, and the fact that he could envision all of this, and not only envision it, but build it and operate it at a time when most people were just struggling to understand what happens when you send, you know, just a single wave from a transmitter to a receiver, and you get a click out of the thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was what most people were trying to understand, and he was already engineering with the stuff.
Do you think he had a fundamental understanding of what we call today pulse code modulation, or was he maybe beyond that a bit and into what we know today as algorithmic synthesis?
I'm not so sure about the algorithmic synthesis part, although, you know, that might be debatable, but I definitely know that he was into pulse width modulation, because on some of his earlier equipment at Warden Cliff that was responsible for part of the equipment that he intended to use to send out all this multitude of signals, if you study the machinery involved, which was specially built for him, they have these very, very unusual and very long rotating switches that are built right onto the shafts of the generators themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was actually conditioning the thousands of watts that he was using to excite this antenna system, and injecting information into it at the same time. And he was using a variation in pulse width and whatnot to accomplish that. But he was doing it with the only way that was available at that time, which was electromechanically, as opposed to using solid state like we do today.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the guy's thinking was good, and there was nothing primitive about that, but the technology hadn't evolved yet to allow him to use something more sophisticated than just, you know, what he had at his disposal, which was essentially electromechanical switches.
But it still shows how brilliant he was and how much before his time he had arrived, that he could even conceive of those things from an analog perspective then. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
It's
fascinating. And if you look into his work, you find that the same basic futuristic mentality pervades everything that he did. Now, give you an example. Tesla never claimed to be the one who discovered X-rays. Pretty much that was Rentgen's work. But the interesting thing was, while Rentgen was fogging photographic plates a few inches away from his X-ray devices, Tesla had already understood the principle and developed his machines to the point where he could X-ray the human skull from 50 feet away. 50 feet! I mean, this guy was producing X-rays. God only knows what that kind of an X-ray flux did to the person at the other end. But the point is that the energies that he was able to muster and focus were extraordinary, considering the fact that the people who started that work were still tinkering around trying to get enough power to expose film a couple of inches away from the source. You know,
yeah.
So everything that he did was superhuman.
One would tend to surmise that that 50 feet was probably a safer distance than, you know, a few inches away or a few feet away, you know, just on the basis of how all of his inventions performed. And, you know, his understanding, I mean, that's indicative of someone that is absolutely connected to the Creator at all times. And if he's sorting things out and testing things out, it's probably that he can transduce them down into a physical realm where the limitations of the physical body and three-dimensional consciousness could cope with what he was transducing from the higher realms. I mean,
oh, I agree with you there, because I can tell you that I'm not putting myself on a par with Tesla, but the few really profound inspirations that I have had were so difficult to translate from the way in which the information was induced into my being, and then try to comprehend it and reduce it to the point where I could express it in this realm is really quite a task, especially when it's something that's totally foreign to you. So Tesla got to have this experience so frequently and became a past master at making these translations that I think that he just wound up opening floodgates that he couldn't even control after a time. You know, so almost like he couldn't stop it if he wanted to, type of thing.
Yeah. Now, I experience moments like that in music quite frequently. And sometimes just the conceptualization of musical principles into the scientific realm or into the physical realm. And it takes a while for that to, I think the consciousness and the awareness comes through when you're actually able to put it into practice in the physical. Not just think about it, but actually create something and observe it and improve upon it. And of course, that's always a goal for anyone that's in a creative art. But I've also found that there's a parallel in the area of my research, which I think you understand to some extent. What I'm getting at here is that we can all do these things if we open up ourselves to the universe. Not nilly-willy, you know, without a care in the world. I think there's a certain amount of integrity that's involved in that. The misuse of these higher forms of knowledge and consciousness certainly would stop the flow of that information or become destructive. And so it's important that in pursuing that one upholds that integrity, that one honors life instead of destroying it. And I think that's one of the sad parts about Tesla's work and his inventions, is that so many of them have been, as you've already alluded to, been used to control people, to subjugate consciousness, to stop consciousness from even occurring. And HARP is one example, and many other misapplications of the technology. And you've often alluded to the ways in which Tesla hid some of his deepest secrets about making some of these advanced inventions really work. Would you care to share anything about that or even comment on what I just said?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I wanted to touch on that anyway, but if you let me back up just a little bit to lay some groundwork before I attack that particular issue, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
I believe that once Tesla didn't perform as quickly as J.P. Morgan wanted him to, it gave Morgan the excuse to pull the plug on Warden Cliff and concentrate on the radio concept that Marconi was trying to evolve. And, of course, it led down a totally different path. The tragedy, of course, was that in losing the support of Morgan, the enormous complex at Warden Cliff just went to ruin, and creditors eventually came and took all the custom equipment, and first they held on to it, you know, and tried to extract payment from Tesla, and then after a year or two went by, they sold it for scrap. So, you know, a lot of the wonderful secrets that were involved in that kind of work that Tesla had started actually wound up on the scrap heap, you know, and that's an amazing thought when you stop and think of it. And it takes me to a lot of really strange places if I concentrate on it. But the reason I brought it up was because of the fact that literally the same thing happened with the wireless transmission of power information also, because the information that was gleaned from his work in Colorado Springs never really got to find commercialization in any way, shape, or form. But there are hints about what happened in the process. Now, if you read really carefully, you'll find out that there was an accident that occurred in the Colorado Springs laboratory. Now, a lot of people feel that that accident was essentially the one that got reported, or part of it got reported in the newspapers, when he burned out two of the dynamos on the local power company, and then he had to take a crew down there and rewire them and restore them to active service himself. And that made a big commotion, but of course he became a hero, even though he caused the problem, because everybody said, well, the guy's a genius. He just walks in here and fixes all this stuff, you know. But associated with that failure, obviously something else happened inside his laboratory, which was not commented on. And one of the things I think was that he was pushing that wireless transmission of power concept to a limit, to find out what its limits were. And we have to remember that that's what that laboratory was built for. And we also have to remember that Tesla was very, very fond of lightning and understood the causes of lightning from the standpoint of the huge potentials of static electricity that are built up by the Earth itself in these thunderstorms. And he had every intention of interacting with it. So the reason I'm mentioning all of this is because I think it's very interesting, if you look at the historical unfoldment of Tesla's life, he didn't get to do anything with the Colorado Springs information directly. Then he went to Warden Cliff, and then Morgan pulled the financial support on that project, and Tesla was forced to do other things to survive. But in the midst of all of this, all of a sudden, we find him scooting around the city of Buffalo, New York, in an electrically powered Pierce Arrow. And according to the people who witnessed this and wrote about it, it had a little antenna thing on the back of it, and he could get in and just start it up, and it didn't make any sound at all except for the purring of an engine, an electric motor. And away he went. Now, there was no place that he could be transmitting power from under those circumstances, because he drove the thing all over the place. So my conjecture is that at that point, he had already realized that under some mysterious circumstance or another, he didn't have to excite the atmosphere with his multi-million-volt magnifying transmitter in order to send power to another location. You could suck it down from the atmosphere directly. And that's one of the things I think he was playing around with this Pure Sauer device. And nobody knows what happened to that thing either. But it just goes to show you that there was something really unusual unfolding in Tesla's private investigations, some of the stuff that he didn't choose to publish. And I'm going to mention one more before I then go ahead and answer your question.
Okay.
Tesla went into a legal dispute with somebody who was trying to steal one of his radio designs for a new commercial transmitting station somewhere on Long Island. And when it got into court, Tesla had been deposed legally, as had the other party. And the prosecuting attorney read a remark from the sworn statement that Tesla made regarding his work, and he said, you have a remark in here that talks about the fact that your transmitter can put out 10,000 horsepower, but it only needs to be excited from a source of 500 horsepower. And so he said, I take it that that implies that you're dealing with instantaneous horsepowers, since there's no way to do that on a continuous basis. And Tesla, who was under oath, said, no, I'm afraid you're mistaken. He says, I do it on a continuous basis. And he said, it can be accomplished very easily without violating any laws of nature. And that transcript is still available. I have a copy of it.
Hmm.
So that's a very interesting admission right there to the fact that Tesla is already working with some form of power amplification that was occurring without the artificial means that we require to do something like that today. And there's one other interesting anecdote that came to my attention a number of years ago. I don't know if you remember the character Preston Nickel, who...
Yes, I do.
He was involved with that
Montauk fame.
Experiment.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I know Preston. I did know him fairly well. I haven't seen him in years. But he told me a really fascinating story about a guy he met who was investigating Tesla, but just from a social point of view. He was interested in his life's history and whatnot. He wasn't a technologist. But he had come to Preston because he knew that Preston was interested in Tesla's stuff, and he had come to him with information that he had found about a penthouse where Tesla had lived, and I forget which hotel it was in, but it must have been during a time when he was doing well financially, because in his later years, I assure you, he didn't live in any penthouse.
Would that have been the Waldorf Astoria?
I honestly don't remember, but I mean, we can dig it up if you like. But the interesting thing was this guy got wind of that fact because the penthouse had been abandoned for quite some time, and the hotel wanted to revive it. And friends of this guy were involved in the reconstruction efforts, and they found a hidden room in the back end of it that had been wallpapered over or something. And at any rate, make a long story short, Preston and this other guy were invited to go up there and see if there was anything of value in there before it was razed. And they went into this place, and there was apparently some instrumentation left from Tesla's time, and they were allowed to take it. And one of the things that they got was a radio, and it was just a receiver, you know, for listening to normal programs and stuff. But the thing that was unusual about it was there was not one resistor in the entire circuit. It was all done with inductors. And I know Preston wouldn't even show it to me, which kind of ticked me off, but he said that he was bound and determined to understand how that could be done. And if the story is true, and of course I haven't seen the device, so I don't know, it shows you also the extraordinary extent to which Tesla's talents had been put to use, and the fact that he was obviously dealing with information that's not available to us today. But to answer your question, I really believe the story about the interaction between Nikola Tesla and the package clerk at the Pennsylvania Hotel back in the 1920s. The story goes that this fellow was always bringing birdseed up to Tesla's room, and of course Tesla used to go out at night and feed the pigeons in Bryant Park, and eventually this package clerk was curious about who's this recluse that consumes all this birdseed, and he wound up meeting Tesla. And as the story goes, Tesla befriended the kid and began teaching him on the basis of a bet, by the way, that was made with the author of Prodigal Genius, John O'Neill, that this guy had come to New York to study commercial art, and whether or not Tesla could sway his interests into electrical engineering. Mm-hmm. Now, that guy turns out to be Otis T. Carr.
Yes.
Who I met many years ago before he died. And I am convinced, having talked to Carr personally and to Carini, who was Carr's technician, electrical technician, and also to Warren Goetz, who was later involved in that whole thing, that there was a blue notebook, which the source of which was Tesla himself, and it had some kind of vital information in there pertaining to, and this is my summation, I can't prove this, but I believe that it was involving the dynamic theory of gravity and how that information could be put to use in the construction of a levitating craft. And I think that the reason why he chose to attempt to transmit information into the future by this unorthodox means had something to do with the realization that Einstein's work in relativity was leading towards the bomb, and all of the technological wonders that had been evolved from the passions of people who loved science were all being perverted by governments and politicians. And so Tesla didn't want his dynamic theory of gravity to suffer the same fate, although it may have ultimately, but he decided to try and rather than publish it in his original format, which was as a rebuttal to the Einsteinian theory of relativity, Tesla wrote up some of the primary secrets involving this discovery and either deliberately gave it to Otis Carr or left it out so that Carr could swipe it. And the reason why I believe it was the second course of action was because years and years later, after Carr had died, I was in a meeting in Florida with Carini, and he allowed me to listen to some tapes, interview tapes that he had made back in the 50s with Otis Carr. And in one of them, he was talking about Carr's relationship with Nikola Tesla. And the interesting thing was that he had asked him if he had ever gone into Tesla's suite in the Pennsylvania Hotel. And, of course, Carr said, oh, yeah, I've been in there many times. He said it was outfitted just like a museum. He said there was hundreds of books everywhere, in bookcases and on shelves and what have you, all over the room. And on top of each bookcase was a model of some of Tesla's inventions. And on the walls were renderings of his Wardenclyffe Tower and his turbines and all these other wonderful engineering drawings that he had on display. And he said there was a great big mahogany desk in front of the windows that was just strewn with books and manuscripts and calculations in progress, and a great big reference table that had everything on there, from maps and scrolls all the way down to big stacks of notebooks. And then out of the clear blue sky, he says, but I never took anything. And I had to listen to that a dozen times before it sank in. I was like, why in the world would anybody say that? You know, here they were in the middle of an interview discussing the fact that they had seen Tesla's suite and been in there, and they're in the midst of describing it, and then they just come out and say, but I never took anything. So it seemed to imply to me that he did take something.
Mm-hmm. Could I comment on that?
Did you or should you?
No. May I comment on it?
Of course.
Okay, now you and I, of course, we know that we've discussed this on previous shows, a few, and to facilitate this topic so that the listening audience doesn't have to go perusing through an archive that may not be there because of some that were lost off the site, but it will be returned eventually. I had come across some research within a few days after I had published my Scherf piece, which I covered Tesla's career and his demise in part one of the piece, which is called Deathbed Confessions, Photos Support Claims That George H. Scherf, Jr. Was the 41st U.S. President. And it, by the way, this has not been denied. It's been confirmed. I stumbled across something which I've mentioned on a show, and of course you're going to recall this, that I discovered one so-called invention of George H. Scherf, Sr., registered in his name at the Patent Office. It was called an illumination lighting control, and I believe that name was a misnomer of a Tesla invention. The drawing I saw, which I determined or discerned was probably, most likely, done by Otis Carr, who was a student at an art school in Brooklyn, where Scherf eventually registered the George H. Scherf Company on the basis of this invention. I suspect that Carr was introduced under the pretense of assisting Tesla with the feeding of his birds, getting the seed to him, and befriending him, much like a spy would, because obviously by this time Tesla had learned to distrust George Scherf to some extent. He was aware of Scherf's involvement working at the Union Sulphur Company, which I pointed out, which was owned by the Rockefeller family, and which was headed by German chemist Hermann Frosch. There was these strange business connections with the central bankers, or banksters as we call them today, that I attributed some responsibility for Carr appearing on the scene. Now, he may have been deemed to be someone who could make drawings of things he saw. In other words, he could, and he may have very well copied some things, eventually stealing that notebook. And I found it interesting that when he founded his flying saucer manufacturing company, the first location he chose was Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah.
Right next door to Washington, D.C. This is prior to his moving the whole outfit to where? Oklahoma City,
and then again to Apple Valley, California.
Yes, yes. And Oklahoma City, I attribute to Tinker Air Force Base, which is part of my current research now. And certain characters in the life of Barack Obama, a.k.a. Barry Satoru, and a mystery name that will come out by the end of this week. It's the connections are too coincidental to be coincidences, if you get my meaning. This is an ever-expanding story, and I found something. You mentioned John O'Neill, which I brought up on a couple of past shows, that I found an individual that I attribute as Prescott Bush and George H. Scherf having worked at Arnold Constable dry goods store in Manhattan, and a customer that had traveled to Manhattan to avoid paying excise taxes on Long Island met Scherf / Prescott Bush, and Scherf invited him to meet Tesla on Long Island, and they made a special trip down there. He bragged about the fact that he was Tesla's assistant. So we know that was George H. Scherf, and what he knew and his mode of traveling on the trains fit the mold of Prescott Bush. Now, many or a few researchers have problems with this because they assume that when they see a photo of these individuals that they're actually seeing a true photo. And I've learned to distrust many of the photos that have been published of these individuals for public consumption. Currently, the ones that we have for the guy sitting in the White House are total fabrications, and I have more to bring to light involving some other very, very prominent people. So I bring all these points up to show that there is such obfuscation and corruption behind the hiding of all of this wonderful, wonderful information that would free mankind. So it's obvious why it's being withheld. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, I think that this is a fascinating area, and I'd love to dig into it more deeply because I knew these guys. But, of course, I didn't know them at the time that they organized their situation in Baltimore, Maryland. But from what Carini told me over the years, there were other people involved, and I can't remember the name of the one guy right now, just because I want to, you know. But anyway, he was one of Carr's right-hand guys, and according to Carini, he was actually with Army Intelligence and had somehow gotten into the Carr organization and was in charge of public relations or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. But it makes you wonder. Now, the other thing that makes me wonder a great deal is that if Carr did steal this book, and if Tesla intended him to steal it, which was even more interesting, then why didn't it wind up directly in the hands of the people who were supposedly Carr's taskmasters? I saw the book on many occasions myself, and Carini told me that it was in Carr's possession the whole time that they were building the OTCX-1 and the OTCX-2 spacecraft, and that he used to reference the book continuously. And, mm-hmm. and he didn't understand most of what was in there, and he was always hitting the bottle, which didn't make it any easier to understand. Mm-hmm. And Carini had the occasion a couple of times when he came in and found Carr sprawled across his desk in a stupor, and the blue book was laying there, that he looked through it. And from what he told me, I gleaned that there were several different drawings in there or descriptions of machines in there which were apparently very important to the overall thrust of the project. But each person seemed to interpret it differently. And Carini used some of the information to try and build an electric car, and when the OTCX1 didn't fly, then the next thing Carr tried to do with it was to build a home power unit. And over the years, when I pieced it all together and I realized it wasn't three or four different machines, it was one machine that was shown in several sections, and each one of these sections was assumed, you know, to be a separate entity by the people who were looking at it. And it seemed as if the only guy who managed to integrate it all together was Warren Goetz, because he had a lot of training in radio and radar work when he was in the Army. And there's another connection to the Army.
Yes.
But the thing that's really strange is the fact that if this was being orchestrated or observed by the elite in some way, shape, or form, the thing that I found really bizarre was that they let it run its own course. Maybe they were supplying money and just waiting to see what happened, or maybe they had another reason for doing it. But they didn't really step in until Carr went awry with his stock sales. And when that OTCX2 model blew up in Oklahoma City back in the 50s, and there was a lot of public promotion over it, and some people were hurt, including Carr himself, who was hospitalized with mercury poisoning. And once it made the public scene, that's when they needed the scapegoat, and they put Carr in jail.
Do you think, Jim, and this is just a hypothesis, but when you mentioned the guy whose name you're having trouble recalling, Army Intelligence, do you think there's the possibility that that individual was a double agent? You remember, these people are all connected with the central bankers, and you're talking about the time, although some of this may have been transpiring after Tesla's death, certainly something might have been transpiring while he was still alive, very old and reserved and somewhat of a recluse. Do you think that these drawings and this technology was given to the Germans, specifically Nazis I'm speaking about, because of their prolific ability to all of a sudden be creating these ships? And do you think that possibly allowing Carr to do this was the smokescreen for what was going on in Germany? Does that make sense?
Well, it could be, but you have to remember one thing. Carr was attempting to do this in the 50s, and the Foo Fighters were flying around in Germany, during the mid to late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So if the two things are related, it's far more complicated than what meets the eye, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, I have the capacity to sort of weed those things out. And to me, the first person you mentioned, again, the individual whose name you had trouble recalling.
I'm trying to look it up as we speak, by the way.
Yeah, just the feeling I got was that's the person that would have probably delivered, the lab notes. Now, if I can share a story with you and the listening audience, and I think I mentioned this on a show about 2 years ago when we were involved in this topic. I had an opportunity roughly about 2.5 years ago to meet someone who related a story to me about Otis Carr's daughter. I don't know if you were aware he had a daughter.
I know he had a wife. I met her. I don't remember the daughter.
Well, this lady and Carr's daughter were driving through an area in the Southwest. And the lady who was driving had the impression that she should stop the car at a particular ranch that she came upon. They're just on a sort of a country road, to use a phrase, okay? It wasn't a main highway. They were on a side road out in the wilderness, so to speak. And they came upon this ranch. It was surrounded by a corral fence. And she stopped at the apron of the driveway. And Carr's daughter got out and walked up to the fence. And a man came out, you know, through the property, met her at the gate, introduced himself. And she said, I don't know what it is, but the lady driving the car, and now I have the impression that we were supposed to stop here. She said, I don't know why. I don't know who you are. And he looked at her, and he said, you must be Otis Carr's daughter. And he said, I have something for you. And he went into the house and brought out a big stack of documents and books and things that had belonged to Carr. And I wonder if the blue notebook was in that stack of documents. Just thought I'd share that with you and
the listeners. That's an interesting thought, but how old would Carr have been at the time?
Well, I don't know that Carr was alive. Carr may have already passed away. This was something that happened not that all that long ago. Okay, certainly.
Well, see, the notebook that I saw was you know, I was in the same room as the thing on numerous occasions, even though I wasn't allowed to look through it. And that was long before Carr died.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless there was more than one of them, you know, which is a possibility.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying the notebook was included in those documents. I just know that there was a transfer of these things, that he had been holding them for safekeeping for quite a long time. And she was certainly surprised to get them. I tried following up on what the demise of those documents might have been, but was unsuccessful. Doesn't mean that it's not a possibility.
The interesting thing about it is that I'd like to find out who that person was and what happened to the pile of material, and where is Carr's daughter?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those would be interesting things to follow up on.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure a lot of people would like to find that out, you know. So, I've been focusing my attention on other things for the past few years, so, as you well know.
I do know, yes.
But I have often thought of that, and I thought it was worth mentioning to those that again, you know, I've saved them the trouble of looking for that archive, if it's even posted. You know, you've done a show every week for the past 2 years. Just to save the time, we have a new recording of this.
Well, and a good one. I remember I remember the time that you mentioned that, you know. I know we had talked about it before.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we don't have any additional information, which is too bad, because that's a real interesting piece of the puzzle right there.
Now, you know, there's another dimension of all of this corporate involvement, we could call it, these so-called self-proclaimed benefactors who eventually stabbed Tesla in the back to an extent, although I understand that George Westinghouse was very, very fair with Tesla. When Tesla did his work at Niagara Falls, he was 51% owner of the company. He owned 51% of the stock. And he was accumulating a lot of wealth, but that wealth was being stolen. It was being pilfered by Scherf. There is no doubt in my mind about that. Now, whether that went into Scherf's pocket or not is questionable. But for the listening audience, we're talking about the guy who would have been the father of George H.W. Bush. George H. Right. Scherf Jr., a.k.a. George H. Scherf Jr. So look at what's going on today with the theft of trillions of dollars and surmise that likely they were pilfering Tesla's royalties and his stock. How does a man, just on that invention alone, how does a man like that end up penniless? It wasn't that his lifestyle was beyond his means by any stretch of the imagination. But then there were those, besides George Westinghouse, you already mentioned John Pierpont Morgan, otherwise known as J.P. Morgan, and there was John Jacob Astor of Waldorf, the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And somehow Tesla was thrown out of that hotel with a $20,000 bill that he assumed was being handled by Scherf. So they actually put him into a position where he couldn't remain in Manhattan. He had suffered the loss of one of his laboratories when he was on 8th Street by fire while he was out of town at Colorado Springs. So there was likely a theft of many of his inventions and his written work at that time, and that could be explained away by fire. And knowing what he knew about power, certainly he would know how to keep the building from burning down when he wasn't there, as long as there wasn't foul play. I mean, it one can simply deduce that. It doesn't take a genius to figure that out. And then Astor was obviously interested in him and was allowing him to stay in his hotel. And Astor was one of the people that perished in the sinking of the Titanic.
Yep.
And I don't buy the story of the iceberg for a moment. Morgan, I sense, was able to eliminate one of his competitors. I don't see George Westinghouse as having been someone of that nature. Morgan, on the other hand, I do, because he was aiding Tesla even after he pulled the plug on the Wardenclyffe project. I'm sure you may agree. At least that seems plausible. Now, I don't mean to cast dispersions on people without the evidence, but it appears to me that a guy that would turn down the type of technology that would bring the most advanced method of delivering power to the whole world would not be able to figure out a way to meter that. He couldn't profit from it himself. And so, therefore, he had to stop it at any cost.
Well, I never bought that story anyway. I mean, because whether it's pumped into the earth or not, it's eventually taken out. And there's no reason why you couldn't put a meter right there where it comes out. It's no different than the thing coming down a pole.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have any problem putting a meter at the bottom of a pole or on the side of your house. You know what I mean? It's,
yes.
It's a BS story. It doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
By the way, the name of that guy was Norman Colton.
Norman Colton.
Yeah.
C-O-L-T-O-N?
I believe so. And actually, there was a whole bunch of people involved in this whole flying saucer demonstration that had, you know, a bad ending out there in Oklahoma City. Even Long John Neville went out there with a portable camera crew. They were supposed to actually be involved with documenting the takeoff, which didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But,
what actually occurred there? Was there an explosion or...
Well, I can tell you exactly what Carini told me.
Okay.
Because I wasn't there, but I have no reason to disbelieve what Carini told me. And he said that basically what happened was that he had found out that there was some problems with the design of the ship. And one of them was that there was no buffer plate. There was supposed to be some kind of a flange made out of fiberglass that separated the top part of the flange from the bottom part of the flange, because the two things counter-rotated and they had opposite charges on them. That was one thing that was missing. And they wanted to do the demonstration anyway, and what that thing was supposed to do was to prevent a short from developing in case, while it was rotating, the flanges got too close and allowed a discharge or something like that. Then there was another problem that had to do with some of the internal wiring. There were some cables that went from the battery bank to some of these electromagnets, and with the information that that Carr gave Carini, he was astute enough to come back and say, hey, listen, there's something wrong with your figures because that cable is too small. And so anyway, he was supposed to go and locate some larger cable, but then the Long John Neville people were going to be coming the next morning, and when Carini came back in with the cable the next morning, he found that it had been already wired with the smaller stuff that they had there, and there was this company called Aircraft Mechanics or something like that that had been commissioned to do the assembly work, and Carini was really ticked off, and he went into to Carr's office and said, well, you know, he said, I told you yesterday the cable was insufficient, and I was going to come back this morning with the right stuff, and here I found it already wired. He said, did you give the order to those aircraft mechanic guys to wire that? And he said, of course I did. He said, we don't have time to screw around with this stuff. We'll replace the cable later. He said, that television team is going to be here in a matter of minutes, and we've got this thing to demonstrate today. And so Carini said to him, well, listen, he said, I'm telling you right now, if there's an accident, I'm out of here, because he said, I forewarned you about a number of things, and you don't listen to anybody. And so then what I understand happened was that there was quite a crowd of people there. I mean, they had people selling souvenirs and sodas and candy and all that stuff and popcorn. And this was out on a hangar, which I think is no longer there from what I've been able to ascertain. And it was a small airport that was right in the middle of Oklahoma City in some kind of a big field. And it was well away from the main part of the city. And they had built this ship out there, and they had it fixed so that it was chained to some kind of rebar or something that was in the floor of the hangar, so it couldn't go anywhere except to the end of the chain if it had actually levitated. And they had a portable panel that they could plug into the main part of the ship so that they could activate it without somebody going inside, because they didn't know how it was going to actually work out. And Carini was the one who took the controls that day. And one of the first things they did was to energize the ship and charge up the hull plates, which would have been the upper and lower capacitor plates of the ship. And then they started this thing rotating, and it was supposed to begin to levitate, I think he said, around, I think it was 3,500 RPM or some number like that. Anyway, it was a pretty good speed for something that large, because this thing was about 18 or 20 feet in diameter. It wasn't big as the Getz ship, but it was pretty darn big.
Now, and, Jim, can I ask what time period we're talking about here?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it's sometime in the early 60s, to mid-60s. I don't have an exact date on it, but it would have been in that area, because it was long after Carr left Baltimore and linked up with Carini. So I would have to say it was like early to mid-60s.
Mm-hmm. Would it possibly have been War Acres? Does that ring a bell?
Oh, well, War Acres is the next town over for me.
Okay.
I don't know if it would have been War Acres, but that's an interesting question. Why did you ask it?
because it's a focus of my research in terms of espionage that occurred over an extended period of time. And I've already written about this to some extent, but I've got quite a bit more to say about it. And War Acres was founded by C.B. War after the closing down of a company called War Industries in the same town. War Industries, founded by C.B. War, was, I think, a military supplier to the War Industries Board, and it was sort of a play on words. And I have great reason for bringing that up. I'm wondering if there's an airport in that town, a small airport.
Well, I asked around about small airports, and there were several which no longer exist. The one that I was pretty sure was the one that Carr had his flying saucer in was further north of here, actually in Oklahoma City, but now that area is a mall. And in those days, it was an open, old-fashioned airport just for small planes, and it had two or three hangars. And supposedly this occurred in one of the older hangars that they had leased for the purpose of this test.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, what happened was that as they brought the speed up on the two rotating flanges, the very thing that Carini was concerned about, they had put some rollers in there on a plywood thing to try and prevent the problem, but they didn't have, you know, it was a half-assed arrangement. And as the thing got up to speed and began to look for gyroscopic stability, the upper flange, which was the larger of the two, began to oscillate. And it eventually came down low enough that there was a huge arc discharge to the bottom one, and then the smaller cable apparently couldn't control the or couldn't maintain the amperage, and there was some kind of a fire inside, you know, the instrument part of the ship, and that led to an explosion in one of the utrons, which were filled with mercury, and this mercury vapor, I guess, according to what Carini told me, when it just burst out of the side of that ship and looked like a great big white cloud. And Carr was standing there, and he took it, you know, he took it the brunt of it, and then he collapsed on stage, and people started running and screaming, and in the meantime, Carini was trying to shut the thing down. But when you have something that's 18 feet in diameter spinning at almost 3,000 RPM, it doesn't stop on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate,
I sense, if I can interject, I sense that the intentional installation of the smaller gauge wire contributed to that, and it was likely sabotage, let's say, to prevent this from succeeding. And, you know, you do this under the cover of you know, so-called media attention. In fact, the media attention became the reason for it to occur. Now, they halt the launching of a space shuttle or a rocket ship, a satellite launching or something like that, on the basis of an approaching storm that might cause some problem. And here the media takes precedence over it. To me, it smacks of sabotage. Now,
well, there's two things about it that are really interesting, and I would sure love to find a way to follow up on it. First of all, if the Nemo team really was there and got that on film, that would be an extraordinary piece of film to have. You know, it must have gone someplace. The other thing that's interesting is, despite the fact that this thing came to a bad end, there was a lot of commotion about it on the Long John Show on TV, both before and after the event. And I never was aware of it at the time. And, of course, that Long John show was on pretty late at night, so I probably wouldn't have watched it under normal circumstances anyway. But the thing that's cool about it was he was on there as a guest with his whole crew. And there was, I wish I could remember the other people's names, but there was one woman had a very, very strange name. She was always hanging around with that bunch. And then there was this guy, Norman Colton, and a few other people, and they were all on this show. And he talked very openly about the work that he was doing with, matter to energy conversion and anti-gravity and all this business, and openly suggested that he had relatively frequent exchanges with, in the old days, with Nikola Tesla, and more recently with Albert Einstein. So it was very difficult to find out, you know, where the facts stopped and the BS began, because, first of all, the guy had a nose like W.C. Fields, and it was not too difficult to find out that he was in love with the bottle. And also, the...
Never did like roses. Go ahead.
And also the fact that he was interviewed by some pretty scientific-type people on the air and never really came out with succinct scientific explanations for anything. He always had these mystical answers and these answers that were, you know, like puzzles.
Cockamamie, would you say?
Yeah, you know, that was the trouble. You know, you could never get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm. I have one question, which I think pertains to this whole topic. My understanding of how these craft fly in different dimensions or in different areas of the solar system and the galaxy and the universe are based upon the principle of, let's say, anti-gravity in the presence of a space body.
Planet.
Yeah, a planet or some other space body. And antimatter, away from the influence of that body or any planetary body. Is there anything that you're aware of in Tesla's research or his understanding, his writings, that allude to that knowledge? And had he considered at all the concept of a symbiotic ship, in other words, one that operates on the consciousness of the individual sitting in the driver's seat?
That last issue I really can't even comment on, because the only time I ever heard about that at all was from, what's his name, out in California.
Ralph Ring?
Ralph Ring. He was the only guy that I ever heard that from. So if Tesla even thought about something like that, I never came across it in any of his writings. However, the antimatter thing, I mean, don't forget, Tesla had words for things that may not necessarily jive with colloquial expressions or even scientifically accepted terminology.
Yeah.
And he used to talk about the fact that that matter which was decomposing on Earth actually had its source for that decomposition in the form of high-speed cosmic rays coming in from space. Now, of course, in those days, a cosmic ray was more or less a catch-all phrase for any unknown radiation or particle that you didn't have an explanation for,
mm-hmm.
you know. So whether or not some of his observations included matter-antimatter reactions is very, very difficult to say, because don't forget, once that occurs, all you have is a little momentary burst of energy. And unless you are consistently investigating this and devise some very sophisticated experiments to try to figure out what's going on. Matter, antimatter, is not what you would call a normal, intuitive conclusion to come to, you know. But when you go to the last of the three things that you mentioned, there's an awful lot written in Tesla's own words about this shift that he envisioned. And I've mentioned it on other shows, you know, where we actually read the description. And I mean, yes. He's talking about levitating and going at speeds that are unheard of and making right-angle turns and, you know, sitting stationary in a geocentric orbit and, you know, all of the things. Oh, and doing all of this with no external propellers or rockets or anything of that sort. And unless he was talking about something we don't know anything about, it certainly smacks of a gravitational drive of some sort.
Mm-hmm. You know, there, you hear these rumors that it's not going to be tolerated to call these craft UFOs. Well, let's begin calling them identified flying objects. Actually, if you see them, you've already identified them. I think the big issue is who they belong to. We're not supposed to know this. You know, I guess we'll get to a point sometime in this society where we'll advance our consciousness to the level that we'll be arguing over who owns the sun. If you get my meaning. It's just a thought.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So we're talking about identified flying objects in the shape of flying saucers is what we're talking about, correct?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, of course, they take on many different shapes, even though they seem to operate in a similar fashion. But the ones that make the most noise usually are the disc-shaped things. And that, of course, was the shape of the OTC X1 and X2 craft. And, I might add, it was also the shape of Warren Getz's craft. But he used to describe it as bell-shaped because it was very similar to the pictures that were taken of that scout ship by that famous contactee back in the 50s.
George Adamski?
Yeah, George Adamski. Thank you. Adamski's ship. And, of course, Adamski had two very, very controversial photographs, and originally I had copies of both of them, but naturally somebody needed them more than I did, so I don't have them anymore. But the ones that were really interesting were the up-close photographs taken from an angle in space where you were looking right up into the vortex of this of a levitating or self-propelling scout ship. But the one that was really impressive was the one of the mothership, because it was so huge that only the part of it that was in the immediate vicinity of the camera was in focus. And as you followed the ship back, you know, you were leaving the capability of the focal point of the lens of the camera that took the picture, and it's a really hard thing, I understand, to duplicate that with a fraudulent arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very, very interesting picture. And then I didn't see this personally, but I heard that he had another picture which was taken from one of the major U.S.-based observatories by a prearranged signal that the mothership would essentially create an eclipse across the face of the full moon. And they put the telescope on that moon and at the particular time that was recommended, and this ship just flew into view and hovered there. And there's this amazing picture that was taken by, I don't remember which one, but let's say Mount Palomar. And, it was there when they said it would be there, and it was so big that it eclipsed part of the moon. And, you know, stuff like that gets swept under the rug, but, you know, there's an awful lot of that around.
Yeah.
And it's about time that all of this was brought out into the open so that we could have a better picture of the way the universe really works.
Yeah. Now, we have the luxury this evening, if you want to continue. I'm waiting for an IM from Seth that we have to close. He's extended given us permission to roll with this a little bit tonight as a Tesla birthday gift, we'll say. I wanted to raise a question which is going to relate to this phenomenon that people describe. Bob Lazar comes to mind when he was he claimed he was working at Area 51 S4 back engineering what they called the sports model of one of nine craft that were in this particular hangar, and he described looking into the craft, seeing these very small seats. Obviously they were made for short beings that he described as probably 2.5 to 3 feet tall based on the size of the seat. And it was obviously there were no controls visible, and he was working on the power plant. He was actually working on figuring out, determining the nature of the drive system of the this particular craft. And he said, and this is the part that I'd like to see if Tesla ever talked about, was the phenomenon of seeing the craft from the outside and looking in and having it appear to be larger. In other words, we're talking about an interdimensional or a multi-dimensional craft of sorts, and that inside the craft, it had the appearance of being larger than what it did outside. Did Tesla ever allude to that type of phenomenon, either in his actual experiments, his studies, or anything that may have been in his lab notes that you're aware of?
No, but I can tell you one thing, that the strangest part of Tesla's untold story, if you want to call it that, seems to go back to whatever that accident was in Colorado Springs Laboratory. And I have always had the sneaking suspicion, and I don't want to tell you why on the air, just in case I'm right.
I can read your thoughts.
I always had the sneaking suspicion that due to the way he was aligning his fields in that transmitter, that he inadvertently stumbled upon the arrangement for a gravitational thrust. And when that happened, my hypothesis is that the main coil literally took off inside the building. And when it did so, it ripped up the connections, between the primary and secondary and caused this short circuit, which reflected back on the power plant in Colorado Springs and burned out the two dynamos, which he then had to, replace. And the reason I say that is because he was talking about building these kind of ships, on and off. He would talk about it for many years. And it wasn't until much later on when this whole Einstein episode emerged that he actually came out, and made statements regarding his discovery of the dynamic theory of gravity. And what got him going on that was Einstein's explanation that gravity was essentially a centrifugal force expressed in four dimensions. And Tesla said, "Oh, rubbish." He said, it's the result of a well-understood field configuration which can be duplicated any time. And he said, I'm going to publish my dynamic theory of gravity, he said, which I have already demonstrated to my own satisfaction is correct. And he said, that'll put an end to this four-dimensional space nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he didn't do it. But the timing is such that if you go back and look at all of the times that he mentioned it, and it was usually on his birthdays, because he used to give these extraordinary interviews on his birthday where in the beginning he would talk about what his latest accomplishments were, and then they'd ask him a bunch of questions, and then he would always end up with his predictions, you know, for what he could achieve in the future. And on several of those occasions, spread across quite a few number of years, he talked about this new type of flying machine, which is what he referred to it as. Sometimes he referred to it as an airship. Sometimes he referred to it as a flying machine. But whenever he described it, it was cigar-shaped for the most part, but it had no propellers, no wings, no thrust of any kind. And the interesting thing is, in some of his earlier graphic illustrations, which included these wireless transmitting towers, they're surrounded in the air with these cigar-shaped ships hovering at different altitudes and shining spotlights down on the ground. And it gives the impression that he originally conceived of powering these things by transmitting the power directly to the ships by wireless means, you know. So whatever they were pretty sophisticated, and he had been thinking about it for a number of years. So when you do a subtractive analysis of that, it brings you back to whatever happened at the Colorado Springs Laboratory.
Now, I'm wondering, and I think you partially answered my question, you know, this thing about the two-dimensionality, and I'm not necessarily saying that that there are actually two separate realities, other than the possibility that maybe the outside of the craft had a, let's say, a vortexian grid that it was able to tune into or adjust its frequency to, and that the inside operated on a different grid. Have you ever given that any thought, or are you aware if Tesla ever talked about anything like that? Because you recently actually did a thesis on one of the shows that we did a few weeks back, you know, where we talked about vortexian theories and the grids, the energy grids that are teeming throughout the universe. I mean, that's what holds everything together.
Well, Tesla, to my knowledge, never talked about it, but I'll tell you who did. Was Goetz. And Goetz often made mention of the fact that a lot of this information was out of the Blue Notebook. The only difference was he never admitted that he stole the Blue Notebook from Carr. He always said that he was tutored by aliens since he was a young boy, and these were all his own notes, you see. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different slant on the story, but the fact of the matter is, one of the things that gets talked about was the fact that the vortex, when it's established, acts like a lens, and it'll act like a lens to various types of radiation, especially light. And one of the things that he cited as proof of this is called the Great Moon Illusion. And it's really pretty interesting when you stop and think of it. If you've ever watched a full moon come up, when it's coming up over the horizon, it's gigantic. Mm-hmm. And then by the time it gets high up in the air, it's the size of like a dime, you know. So it goes from this huge size, you know, to this little silver disc in the sky, just by changing maybe 45 degrees in elevation.
Is
and
that
I can't
because
believe,
of refraction, would you say? I mean, that's just light refraction, right? Or
yeah, but the point is, what's it refracting through? You know, the explanation that was given was that this invisible vortex acting like a lens makes it look larger, and then when it gets up to the full zenith where it's not going through this lens, to the same extent, it looks its more realistic size. Well, that's very similar to what you're talking about, but the only observation I would make is that if it's true, then it could only happen when the vortex was established, And it's a very, very high voltage to do that, and I don't think you'd be peeking in with the vortex spinning around this craft. Mm-hmm. I think you'd be knocked on your keister.
Well, yeah, I'm certainly speaking about being inside. If it's in operation, you would be inside. If you're outside the craft looking at a craft that's operating, what you will see, and I know this about the craft of the United Galactic Federation, the top spins clockwise. Now, that doesn't mean that the inside of the ship is spinning around. It's operating independent of what moves as the anti-gravity, and I've only seen it in an anti-gravity configuration or operation. I've not seen it with antimatter kicked in. I don't think anyone would see it, to tell you the truth, at those speeds. So I bring that up, that one possible explanation would be that there are two separate energy fields. The one that, they may be vortexian grids, one that operates at a specific frequency, causing anti-gravity to occur, you know, or facilitating anti-gravity, permitting it to operate with the top of the craft spinning and the base stationary, and those inside perfectly stationary, likely not even feeling any motion.
Well, I'm sure that they wouldn't feel any motion, especially if the forces were gravitational in nature, because there'd be no relative forces involved, and that's the only way that you can appreciate inertia and momentum. But, getting back to your description, the Getz craft, the upper flange, which was the bell-shaped flange, I think was supposed to rotate clockwise, and the flatter flange that held the big electrostatic accumulators rotated counterclockwise. Mm-hmm. And the cab, as it was called, where the occupants resided, that didn't turn at all. And that was established by means of this amazing transmission, which allowed a flange one turn and the counter flange the other turn, and the supporting shaft, which was also the magnetic pole of the ship, not to have any relative motion with respect to the other two.
Uh-huh. Now, is there any chance that there was a magnetic field or an electromagnetic field or electrical field between the upper flange and the lower flange?
Oh, there were all kinds of fields. I mean, that thing was a very complicated machine. Not only was the upper and lower flanges charged, there was also the magnetic flux of the central pole of the ship, which was involved. And then inside the lower flange were these amazing conduits, which was something like, I would almost say like a waveguide, except that they were round. And he was building them out of, I think it was eight or ten inch, galvanized, stovepipe, you know, which I thought was pretty funny. I said, here you're building a ship that can leave the atmosphere, and one of the key components is, stovepipe, you know. And he said, well, you have to understand, he said, the type of electricity that flows through that actually seeks out the geometric center, and it will flow right down the middle of that pipe from one static accumulator to the other. Now, at the time, I didn't know this. Well, I didn't forget what he told me, but there is a form of current that does do that. And guess who reported on it? Was Wilhelm Reich. And unbeknownst to a lot of people, Reich built accumulators, smaller accumulators that were very high-powered, and they were referred to as shooters because they had a piece of BX cable with nothing inside of it. The wires were pulled out, just the BX shielding, coming out from the interior of the accumulator which he would then use for local treatment. And he had to wear an insulated glove when he touched it, this thing. And essentially he would use that to, you know, like if somebody had a wound on their leg or something, and he would actually use this to shoot orgone energy at that location. You know,
yeah, it's like a fiber optic cable is what you're describing, of sorts. I'm not saying the same information is inside, but yeah.
Yeah, so, and then that jives also with the so-called Cloud Buster, which was another hollow tube that drew stuff down through it. And if you read the early writings of the alchemists, the springs that they used to look for, which supposedly was like the origins of the legend of the Fountain of Youth, was always situated in a place where there was a spring coming up from the ground in the hollow of a dead oak tree that had already been hollowed out and was tall enough, you know, to pierce the forest canopy and point at the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fascinating combination, because there you have a natural draw tube, you know, pulling the orgone energy down from the sky, goes down through the hollow tube of the tree, and I believe it would create or call for the production of a spring in that region. It's not that the spring just happened to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Those forces created or drew that water up from underneath the ground.
Yeah.
So it could have very interesting properties. And, you know, water is diamagnetic.
Yes.
Which means that it's already got properties that are the reverse of paramagnetic or ferromagnetic compounds. So there's so many things we don't understand. It's just amazing.
Is the spring selected or necessary because of its vortexian shape? In other words, does that facilitate the proper motion of the energy to cause something to move from one place to the other in that respect?
Well, I think what it does, and I'm guessing because I'm certainly no expert, but I think what it does is it has an effect on the internal energy of that water. And,
mm-hmm.
and the magnetic component of that water, which makes it super hydrating. Because, when you drank that water, it gave you renewed vigor and a return to a youthful state. Now that doesn't mean that you ran around in diapers. It means that, it means that your cellular structure was reinvigorated.
That
and
depends.
Actually, well, let's not go there right now.
Go ahead,
and,
Jim. I'm sorry.
You know, and the thing that's interesting about that is almost all disease can be traced back in one way or another to improper irrigation of the cells, and
mm-hmm.
particularly aging, the formation of wrinkles, and the loss of elasticity in the skin. You know, and the lack of firmness in the blood vessels and in the blood itself, all of this is related to water or the lack of water in the body. So if you have water that's super hydrating, by its very nature, it's going to have a very different effect upon you than normal water.
Yeah, and I think
all of this has a lot to do with what the alchemists were after.
Yeah, there is a, if you say water is life, then there is life force within the water. And, as a person gets older, they, especially in this repressive system here, in this three-dimensional prison we call planet Earth, there is the constant struggle to move upward, in higher states of consciousness. And the loss of that life force causes one to accept the prospect of aging. I think a lot of it has to do with mindset and the very fact that dumbing down shuts off those natural, capacities that we have within us as creative beings. we're told that we live a certain amount of time, that there's an average lifespan of a human being, and therefore we accept that premise without even questioning it, without even challenging it. And so it comes to pass merely because the suggestion has been made and no other possibilities outside of pharmaceutical drugs are offered as potential ways of achieving a higher state of health and consciousness. I think the two go hand in hand.
Oh, I'm sure they do. But on the other hand, if you read the writings of Schoberger, he will tell you that the modern concept of processed water, whether it's by happenstance or by design, takes all of the vital energies out of the water, and the water that you get at the tap in your home is dead from an energy point of view.
Yeah.
And of course, over and above that, if you add to the complexity of the problem the fact that it's just inundated with only God knows how much unnatural rubbish in the form of chemical and biological residue. We don't even know what the heck we're drinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I have, you and I have talked about that, I think, also on some other shows, and I have very strong feelings about that, because if that's true, if it can be brought down in its vibratory capacity, it can be induced to go in the other direction, and it wouldn't necessarily have to go through a chemical process to achieve that, would it?
No, it wouldn't. As a matter of fact, Schoberger tells you how to do it.
He didn't tell me. No, I'm just kidding. He didn't tell me.
He says that the way it happens, literally, is because of the fact that the water is constantly passing over rocks and spinning and zigzagging and flowing around eddies and all of this motion. And as a matter of fact, he warned people in Germany that had the interest of straightening out several of these rivers because they wanted to encourage barge and boat traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And the rivers were had too many rapids and too many twists and turns, and they just said, well, let's just straighten it out. We'll have one nice big super highway here right up through the middle of the country. I don't remember what river it was. But the point is, Schoberger said, well, if you do that, he said, here's what's going to happen. He said that whole corridor that you're going to create is going to be devoid of life on both sides within less than a year. So if you're passing through areas that are agricultural, nothing's going to grow there. And if you used to have forest that came up to the water's edge, he says you can forget about that. He said it's going to die back away from the water's edge because none of the vitality will be left in the water. And they just looked at him like he was nuts.
You just gave me a brilliant idea. Let's lobby for the straightening out of the Potomac River.
I think there's enough sterility in Washington already, don't you?
Well, Jim, this is fascinating, and I could keep going, but we do have to bring the show to a close. I have the distinct impression still that Nikola Tesla is listening to us, looking down upon you. He's asking every time I speak, who is this guy? You know, and but your information and the piece that you read at the top of the show is just top shelf stuff. It's inspiring. It's revealing. I'm sure the listening audience is chomping at the bit to hear more of this. And we have to do this again in the future, not just on July 10th, but I want to give you the opportunity in closing to wish Nikola Tesla a happy birthday in the way you would like to do that. I truly feel he's listening right now.
Well, I hope he is listening, and not only do I wish him a happy birthday, but I thank him for giving us a world which was part of his vision and part of his function as a created being on this world. And furthermore, I thank him personally because it was his energy and his accomplishments that basically propelled me in the direction I chose for my own life. And even if I never accomplish the goals I've set out to do, I can tell you this, the life I've had so far as a result of pursuing Tesla's unfinished work has given me more experiences and more excitement than the average person could ever imagine in the course of a normal life. So I thank him from the bottom of my heart for all those things and also for personal things such as inspirations and guidance, which I know I've had over the years. So with that, I would say happy birthday, Nikola Tesla, and I love you.
Well, well said, and I have to say that as I listen to you speak about Tesla, I feel the same things about you and your contribution to the show over the past 2 years. You've been steadfast and reliable and inspirational and creative and informative and inspirational again, so my hat is off to you as well as to Nikola Tesla. Happy 153rd birthday, and may you have many, many more. And may we honor the work that you've done in your life and the influence, the creative inspiration that you've left here for others to recognize and to fuel the torch that burns within all of us that are interested in arriving at the truth. Jim, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. It was fantastic. I can't wait to hear this archive played back. And I'm sure you may even find it interesting.
Well, I'll listen to it also, I assure you.
Okay. Jim, you have a great weekend. I look forward to you being on the show again next week. And it's time to say goodnight, so I'll say goodnight to everyone. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special Friday night guest, resident science advisor, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and our good friend, admirer tonight, and not just tonight, but every day of his life, of Nikola Tesla, who we honor on his 153rd birthday. Special thanks to Don Newsom and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Seth Hendrick on the sound, especially for the extra time that we got tonight. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us again next week when we've got more shows planned for you. Great guests, lots of interesting information. For those of you who are interested, I will be appearing on Drew Raine's A Marine's Disquisition for 2 hours on Monday, beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Mountain, and 2 p.m. Pacific Time. That's Monday afternoon, this coming Monday. Look forward to seeing you there. Greetings to all our friends out there around the country in the U.S. military. We wish you a Godspeed in your return, your safe return home. And also, we would like to say hello and good night to our friends in the United Galactic Federation. Our prayers and thoughts are with you folks. To you in the listening audience, I wish you a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.